So we were just starting to talk about your work at Hudson Engineering Corporation, and your work as a process engineer there. And so what were some of the projects and types of projects, and maybe if you have specific ones that come to mind, that you would be, you worked on in that role?
Okay, I was going into process design engineering 20 years after I had earned my engineering degree, having spent the previous time in basic research. And I had been taught all of the theory of what to do, but I had very little practical experience in that field. And so I first started out, as an engineering design company, you sometimes get projects for a short study of the feasibility study of a certain thing, and so you do a study of that. So I was assigned, my first assignment was that type of a short-term study. And I did my study, and I wrote up, it's kind of funny, before I got a permanent place to sit, you sit in this chair, this office while you're going. The office that they put me in was the guy who was the head of the process engineering department. He was off at a startup, running the startup, because he'd been the process engineer on that job, so he was responsible. He comes back and, what are you doing in my chair? He turns out to be my immediate boss then. But at any rate, I wrote this report up, and after 20 years in academia, I was more accustomed to writing in the academic style. And so he looked and he decided, you know, Patsy, this isn't any good. This doesn't sound like a business report. It sounds like a, you know, a publication in AICHE, a journal. Okay, I said. So I went home that night and I rewrote it and gave it to him the next day. I constantly amazed people at how quickly I could work. And so I rewrote it and it was fine and it did. And so then I did it a little bit more and then that type of thing, and then I was assigned. Well, next thing I did was go out to the startup, as participated in a startup for the first time in the field over in Louisiana, and we had a blasted idiot for a, pardon me, I lowered my voice because I don't like to be so negative about someone. We had a younger engineer who was representing our client as their on-site process engineer. And the gentleman, unfortunately, had poor judgment, safety-wise. Mm-hmm. Then when I arrived, the first night, we had a meeting because this man, the previous day, had, the instrument man had tagged off the line. That means you put a big sign on it, don't touch this, I'm working on the line, you know, type of thing. And he was sitting cross-legged, unscrewing the instrument air from the instrument that he was getting ready to replace, when this idiot opens up the valve and pressures in the instrument air. And this is, you know, you've got pressure and you go, it comes in. It blew the valve off. Fortunately, he was sitting cross-legged with his legs far enough apart that it went between his knees and into the ground and disappeared. He could have been castrated. So that night we decided, the next day, that happened. The first day I was there, I went out to observe, and we had a fired heater in this process. A fired heater is a great big furnace. This one was so big it had 10 different pilot lights to get it going. So you have the master gas valve is sufficiently far away that it used really well. So it had been knocked off, and the guy who's the process engineer in charge of things goes around and his lights all of these 10 things. He finishes number 10 and starts stepping away, and it's his job, the lighter of the pilot, to go and turn on the gas. Mr. Client opened up. Fortunately, our man was not hurt. That was the night that we had the meeting, and we had a new assignment for our group. And then what they did, they sent the process engineer and whatever other process engineers he could gather, he or she could gather, and instrument engineers, to go and start we actually started operating the plant when we built something we made sure it worked. So from that point on, we had one person watching this man to make sure he did not kill anybody. It was primitive. And the difference between the scale of things that you work with, there was some particular thing on that job, or there was this, so I've forgotten what it was, but underneath it was a connection, and it had this gigantic nut, like you screw onto us, and you have to have a big wrench to turn it. And the wrench was so big, and in the position it was in, and we had to have all of us guys who were working on this job in a big circle around, lying down on our stomachs, and where you would push it, your little arc of this big circle. I mean, it was, you know, like a 10-foot length on this thing, and we pushed it around with enough, and to put gradually warm, tighten it up or loosen it up, whatever it was that we did. No, it was an interesting time to do, and after having spent time in the laboratory essentially for so many years, it was a big change. So I did that, and then I came back, and then I got assigned my own project, the South Pass project, and I designed it, and we built it, and I went to we actually built it in our yard and put Arthur someplace like that, and I got to go to the yard and see it being constructed. And they were doing it in two pieces. It was an offshore platform, and you know, they would fit together like this, like your fingers fitting together. Unfortunately, instead of doing it in that type of alignment in the field, they did it with both hands pointing in the same direction instead of pointing towards each other where the fingers would mesh up. So when they got offshore and tried to meet the two together, one was about 2 feet above the other. So we had to modify in field offshore. And all of the decks and all of the piping had to have this gradation of this difference in whatever the difference was, I don't remember, you know, 4 inches, whatever it was, you had that gradation in all of the piping and all of the flooring offshore. So then I got to go offshore and to do the startup of an actual operation of a plant. An interesting thing, I got to take with me a young engineer who had just graduated from Rice, who happened to be a classmate of my oldest daughter's in high school, in junior high. So it was somebody, you know, I knew his parents and everything. Well, he was my gopher, and I'm really glad I had him. So we got offshore. Well, naturally, as a woman, you've got to do everything that the guys do. So I went out on the flare boom, and if you've ever been offshore on a platform that is, you know, well elevated above the water, and then you have this gigantic flare boom that's 50 feet long, that's out at an angle over the ocean. Well, you see me sitting in the chair. Okay, there's the ocean floor, it's the floor. And where my knees are is where the platform level was. And this is the flare boom sticking out, my arm sticking out. And you stick it out there. It's pretty scary, especially since the steps going out on this flare boom are only about 3 inches wide. And you can barely fit on them, and there's just kind of a piece of chain rope to hold onto getting out there. Well, I went out there one time. Subsequently, when I wanted to have a picture made of the platform, I sent my gopher out there to do it.
So sometimes there's a rite of passage.
I had to prove that I could do it.
Were you out on that flare boom for some reason, or just?
Oh yeah, I went out to inspect something rather that we had. I mean, I showed them I could do it, but then after that, I had Paul do it. Why should I do it again?
Now, I think you told us earlier you never learned to swim. Were you
petrified
to go out on this flare boom? Or?
Yes, scared silly.
But yet you did it.
Yet I did it, yeah. Now, part of what you have to do when you go to a startup situation like there is you follow your mechanical flow diagram that has all of your pipes on it, and you follow and make sure that every pipe is where it's supposed to be and has every valve in it. That's part of what you do to check out a new installation. Did you ever do this? You did this too, okay. Well, she's nodding too, so. It's a very tedious process, and it's very, and sometimes they are in very places where you can't imagine you can get to them. Well, luckily I had Paul to crawl into those places. Paul, fortunately, was a rather small man, and I'm glad that he was, because he could get and reach behind and look and see where things were supposed to be. But I was on the floor checking off stuff, as they did. And, oh, we had to. Anyway, we got that platform going. Maybe I did another design or two. I don't remember.
So talk a little bit more about this startup. So this was not your original project. So you just got named to a startup crew?
Oh, the original startup I went to, I was named to it. Yeah. He got ready to do a startup, and I was a new engineer at the company. You need that training, go.
So did they train you what to do, or you just
figured it out?
You got
there and you did it.
Okay.
I mean, you were a trained engineer, so you knew how to do.
Were there, like, process hazard reviews that took place?
No.
Or?
Except for our client. Yeah, that was the hazard that we had to discuss.
Okay.
You were just expected to know.
Now, how did you get out to this offshore platform?
Oh, the option. Okay, the first experience was onshore. My offshore. That one. I think that was the one. Well, I went offshore 3 or 4 times. One time, I went off in a helicopter and landed on the helipad. And the helipad is a flat landing place at the very tip-top level of the platform. And there is a opening in the helipad with a staircase leading down to the next deck. There is not a handrail, anything to hold onto until you step down into these steps. And you have to do this with your luggage, your personal luggage is in a duffel bag over your shoulder. And you have to do this that way. And that's very difficult and very scary. Another time I went out in a crew boat, and those you get on board at the dock or the wharf, and then you go bump 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 out in the Gulf until you reach the platform. The platform is built with a landing at the sea level, where the sea level is with respect to the platform, and then you have to climb up a long bunch of stairs to get up to the first level of the deck. And the first deck is 25 to 50 feet above sea level. And most platforms are multi-decks. Three levels is typical, and each deck I'm using kind of general, 15 to 20 feet in depth or more. Depends on what type of platform it is and what you're doing and all. So there's a lot of climbing up and down of stairs involved on platforms. The third way of getting on board, of course you have to get off board the same way too, involves going out in a boat, and instead of docking at a docking on the platform, you stop off, and there is a operating crane. A crane is a piece of mechanical equipment that can lift, has a hook on it that can lift things and move it around and set them down. So it has a hook on it, and it goes over and sets down on your boat a big inner tube-like thing. Mm-hmm. And the big inner tube thing is maybe 12 feet to the outer diameter. And so it has maybe bigger than that. Anyway, it's a great big inner tube. And in the center of which is a netting to the inner tube. And then around, supporting the inner tube are boat or ropes that you can hold on to. So you put your duffel, your luggage, in the center of the inner tube thing, and you stand on this inner tube thing and hold on to the ropes. And the crane has to pick up with respect to the waves that are going up and down on your boat, and it has to put it down at the right time and you have to jump on and get ready to go real fast. And then it has to pick it up at the right time and go over and set it down on the platform. And when it sets down on the platform, or in the reverse condition, you have to be prepared to flex your knees as it goes so that you won't break your knees. And you're taught this just before the first time that you have to go this way. And so I had, in the years of going off, like I said, several different times that I went offshore, and I went all three ways. And it's very interesting.
And how long did you usually spend offshore when you went?
It depends on what it was for.
Okay.
If it was for the startup, I was offshore about 10 days. It takes about 10 days to check out a plant and get it running. 10 to 2 weeks, something like that. When I... other times I went out to... I did not spend the time offshore. I just went out for a day and came back for going out to look at something to see about changing it or whatever it was. I forgot the details.
Mm-hmm. And this was in the early 80s, late 70s?
I went to work for Hudson in 76. The early 70s was when the first time I went offshore. Late 70s.
How many other women were kind of doing this kind of work offshore? Did you see anybody? Or
I don't remember seeing anybody.
How did the men treat you offshore?
Very politely. I was the head engineer, and so they treated me the way you're supposed to treat your head engineer. The frightening thing I had was on one of the offshore trips, which will remain unnamed, and they were not enforcing the safety rules, and their fire pumps were not operational for fighting fires. That's rather scary.
I believe you had some projects that you were involved with at Hudson that were in different places abroad, like Japan. And so I'm wondering if you ever traveled to those sites or how long you spent abroad for that kind of work.
Okay, I did both process and project engineering. In fact, I started project engineering fairly early in my career. I guess it was because of the experience that I had over the years, and then being a rather senior person, you know, I wasn't straight out of school. So some of those were that type. And depending on what the project was, you did or did not need to go to the site. Mm-hmm. I never had to actually go and do any startup overseas.
Okay.
Some very interesting stories about different aspects of those startups. All of the startups I participated in were here in the United States. And I did mine, I did PATS, I did something in New Mexico. I only went to startups maybe 3 or 4 times total, because I almost immediately went into project engineering. And the overseas ones, let's see. Well, first of all, there was a project. The overseas projects that I worked on, at one time I went overseas to work in London, but I didn't go offshore in the North Sea. The project was North Sea. So I did go to work, but not on site was in London, if that makes sense.
Yes.
The African project, I was the lead project engineer. It was a really interesting project. And I did not go overseas for that. Then had a lot of, I'm glad I didn't. Our guys that had to go told some horror stories about the guys coming out of the jungle and fighting them on shore and running and being, they're having their truck or whatever they were going from one place to the other being stopped by armed guerrillas. And, you know, at least they all came back safely. The Japanese was a joint venture design thing, and I was project engineer for that one. And I knew all of the technical information. And we decided that we really needed to have a joint meeting with the Japanese company. And this was decided on Monday, and they applied for our, or maybe they decided on Friday that they were going to do this. and applied for the things, and we got the papers on Monday that we could go, and on Tuesday we flew to Japan, to Tokyo, and the head of the engineering department was named Clower, C-L-O-W-E-R at that time, and he went on it, and the salesman, Hudson had a bunch of people where they sent you the salesman, and they did all sorts of sales and deals, and I'll talk about them later too, to get these jobs. And so he went, and they had a representative of Hudson in Hudson McDermott. It was McDermott Hudson at that time, whatever the name was, in Japan, also, who had been working on developing this thing. So we met with Mr. Clower had been a prisoner of the Japanese in World War II. And so on the way over, he gave me instructions about how I was supposed to behave as a woman and everything. And so then we went in and we got to Japan, and we had enough time to accommodate and change the time change was radical. And then we met with the company, and we started our meeting with everybody was in there, including all their design engineers as well as all of their business people, and started talking about the project. And about every second question, they had to turn to me to get the answer. And very shortly, the business people decided we would separate, and the business people would go do the business aspect of the discussion, and we would do the technical part, and left me with all of the design people. And I answered all of their questions. And at the end of the day, they took us out to dinner, and we went to a very fancy restaurant, and I was given the seat of honor to head the table. I was in the one with the great big chair with the big thing around it. I mean, that was a seat of honor, and I got it. You know, they sit here. And I was treated very... And then the Japanese host invited us to his home for coffee or whatever, you know, to come there. And we went to his home, and you took your shoes off at the door and put on the... I'd heard of this custom, never seen it practiced before, and changed our shoes and everything, and got to meet his wife and have whatever it was. And on the way back to the hotel, our representative, who was living there permanently and had been there for 2 years at the time, commented he had never been invited into a Japanese home before. Hmm. So that was pretty interesting. Well, it so happens that in talking with the technical people, I mentioned casually that, oh yes, I had known a lot of Japanese engineers. And we had this man who came and did a postdoc with us, a very interesting man, and dropped his name, and he just happened to be the president of Kobe Steel at the time, yes. And he was one of the ones, the way of thinking, apparently there's something in the culture that made it very difficult for him to envision very limiting behavior of you have the solid, and the gas reacts with the solid, and as the solid becomes less and less, the reaction goes down and down until finally the limitation is the solid is no more, but yet the attraction still exists. This is a complete abstract idea, and it was essential for the work that he was doing in chromatography to understand he was doing a brilliant piece of work, but this particular concept of limiting behavior was very, very difficult for him to grasp. And I think it was language. And like I say, the guy ended up president of a major steel company. I mean, he's plenty smart. It was interesting. And that was very interesting. And the taxi drivers all wore white gloves. So we finished our meeting, and the men that were with me, the two men, flew back to the United States. But I said, no, if I'm flying this far, I'm staying or another day to be a tourist. And so I spent one day being a tourist in Tokyo by myself and flew back the next day.
And so you mentioned, you know, thinking about being a woman in Japanese society. What was it like in other countries, whether it was England or other places you went around the world? Did you encounter other women engineers, or how
yes,
were you
received? I met other women engineers. mm-hmm. in other countries. I don't think I met any in England when I was there working as an engineer. I'm trying to think. Don't think I met any there at that time. I may have met some later, but I don't remember any. I definitely met women engineers when we went to adopt our children in Romania. So
you made the distinction of process engineer versus project engineer.
Yes.
Did you have certain things you liked about those two things, or how are they different for kids that are trying to understand what they might want to pursue these days?
Process engineering is actually working with the basic principles of chemical engineering to get something done. Project engineering is integrating that process engineering with all of the accompanying supporting engineering efforts to get something done. And you have to understand the process, you really have to understand the process to do that. And you have to also understand something, but not everything, about all the others. And you have to appreciate that they have to all work together in order to accomplish something. One of my overseas projects, which I did, we never did build the project, which was very, very interesting. Excuse me, spam likely strikes again. Okay, that was early 1980s or something like that. That was a huge project. I probably employed 80% of the staff on that.
Is this Saudi Aramco?
Saudi Aramco.
Okay.
Yanbu, YAMBU. Have you heard of that? It was the Yanbu project. And we were one of the people who, the engineering companies that were willing to bid on it. They wanted a no exception bid. That means for $6,000, I will build you this exact thing that you have said in your drawings. That's what a no exception bid means. Well, when we got to working on this to do it, if we were going to bid a bid that way, it was going to be $200 or $200 billion, whatever the numbers were. I'm trying to do order of magnitude here. It was going to be 200. Whereas if we applied general accepted engineering practices, instead of 200, it would be 60. Okay. So they wanted a no exceptions bid, and they sent out their specifications. Have you ever seen Aramco specifications? Mm-hmm. Their general specifications, not the ones for the project, their general specifications on how you're going to do things, are in little notebooks, notebook. And the notebooks start at this end of the house and go all the way to the other end of my house. And then there's another set of notebooks that were for this particular project. And then there were the drawings that had all been, all the preliminary engineering had been done, you see. And then there were all of the drawings, that the preliminary drawings, and there were, how many rolls? Five rolls of drawings, and each roll of drawing was a good 14 inches in diameter. 14 inches of diameter of drawing size, and a drawing is 4 feet by 3 feet, roughly, and they're all rolled up into a giant roll. So there were lots and lots of stuff to do. So when I was appointed to be the project engineer for this, I sat down and looked through all of the drawings and read through all of the books. It took me about a week. And I saw that in order to do a no exception bid, I would need everybody to really know what was in all of those things. So I reserved our major conference room for a week, and I had been appointed a lead engineer in each one of the major disciplines. And I told them that they had, if you're working for me, you're on this project, and I get all of your time for my project, you're going to meet with me next week, and we're going through the specifications. Never heard such howls of dismay in all of your life. And we started doing it. and we're going merrily along, and there's a specification in the whatever it was, fire protection section, that affects how much steel you have to put into that platform. And when you do an offshore project, that steel structure that you stick in the ground that really doesn't do anything is a huge percentage of, and I've forgotten the exact percentages, say it's 30% of the cost of the facility. So instead of this, and so that 30%, instead of being $30, is now going to be $50 because of the fire specification that's in the fire section, not in the steel section. And that sort of thing was throughout these documents, where there would be something in one section that really affected, the instrument guy was affected by something was in the electrical section or vice versa, whatever it was. And we went through that thing. So by the end of the job, we had this long list, end of that week, we had this long list of, this is what they said they want, but really we don't think that's practical. We ought to do something else. So we did two bids. One was meeting the no specification thing, and then we handed our management the second bid. This is really what you ought to try to negotiate. And we were the only company to turn in a bid with no specifications. And our management told them they'd be happy to discuss, and they wouldn't even discuss it with them. A bunch of egotistical maniacs. Pardon me, but they were. Eventually, the company, we never bid on the other Aramco project. But I saved the company from going bankrupt on that. I think that was one of my major accomplishments. And you just really, sometimes you really have to bite the bullet and say, we can't do this. And they were very, somehow the Aramco management finally managed to find somebody to do the job, and they eventually, it was the number, you know, when you're talking about what's trillions of dollars, or I mean, the numbers get so big that they really don't make any sense to you anymore. That's why I was using numbers I can handle, 260. I can really know what those numbers are. But you need to put a lot of zeros under behind those numbers. I don't even remember the dollar magnitude that we had, but it was huge.
It's a good example of when saying no makes sense. Were you afraid to kind of bring that forward? I guess by having the two bids for management to review, you were
kind of... Oh, no, I took it up with them early on. After that, you know, after we did the review, I talked to our management, what should we do? And they made the decision, let's go ahead and bid it. But I ended up having almost everybody in the company working on that. And I worked extremely long hours on it. And one Monday morning, I went in and I met Johnny. And, are you working on my project? Patsy, I worked 50 hours on it last week. Oh. As project manager, I was responsible for managing all the hours of everybody. So I walked into the secretary and said, I'm going home. This was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I went home and I went to sleep and I didn't wake up till 6 p.m. When we finally got the bid documents ready to go, of course the bid documents were gigantic too, and our printing department, you know, had printed off all the copies, and so we put them together, and then we had to be sure that every copy was, you had to do 14 copies or whatever it was, or 30 copies, whatever the number was, you wanted to make sure that every copy was perfect. And so you sit there with the master copy and you say, page so-and-so, blah, 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 and everything. 14 people out there with 14 copies, you know, going this way to make sure your copy is right. And everybody in the company would come down, including the vice president, and spend an hour or two working on that. Because, I mean, it was a huge hunk of our investment time. It took us 6 or 8 hours to prepare. Just that going through and checking that all the papers were in order. That step alone.
Well, it's a great example because we started this section on Hudson talking about you like their integrity.
Yes.
Because in some cases there'd be pressure for sales, so let's do a bid knowing it might be a little lower and we'll just escalate from there.
Yeah.
It was a different approach for this.
It was a different approach. I liked the approach that they had. at the Hudson Company. The influence of McDermott I did not like that came in. But Hudson maintained some of his, you know, original quality for a long, long time. During the time I was there, it was there for sure.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes engineers can find themselves in sort of, we could call it an ethical dilemma. If they're getting pressure to figure out how to meet both these constraints.
I had an interaction sometime along the way, and I don't remember when it was, with a young female engineer who worked for one of the, it may have been Dow, chemical company. And there was something that she felt was, or knew, was not a safe thing to do. And she consulted, because she was worried that she would lose her job if she said anything. And I told her she had to go ahead and say something. And she did. And she did not lose her job. No, I had that. That this is an ethical dilemma of when do you insist. I had the I had a project, and I've forgotten which one it was, which client. It was an offshore project. And by that time, we had developed through API, the American Petroleum Institute, the API RP 13C. That's American Petroleum Institute Recommended Practice. And it's for the safety of design of offshore facilities. The criterion that is in there was developed by industry, for industry, and govern industry. It's now the legal law. At that time, it was not legal law. It was simply best practice. And the client insisted that we not, tried to insist that we would not utilize that. And as lead project, as the project engineer, I had to sign off on all the drawings before they could, and I refused to sign off.
Those are some great examples.
Well, we eventually did sign off because they did eventually agree with 14C.
Okay. So talking about signing off drawings, in some other engineering fields, there's something called professional engineer.
Yes.
Did you and pursue I'm, that? Or
yes, and when I went to work for Hudson, they requested that I become a professional engineer.
Okay.
And so I prepared my papers and was registered in Texas. And I went in under the grandfather clause. I did not have to have an examination. By that time, I had my application. I went and got all of the papers. See that stack of papers there? And I went through and made my long list of what I had done and what my contributions were for each one of those. It took a long time just to prepare the application. And so I became a registered professional engineer in Texas. Later on, working for Hudson, getting ready to do somebody wanted Alaska, a project there. So we didn't have anybody registered in Alaska. And they asked me to submit. So I submitted one, including the information that I had done the design for the two of their major pipelines. And they wanted me to take an exam and to come up for an interview, and I told them to shove it.
Was there continuing education required for professionals engineers?
Not at that time, no.
Okay.
Well, I had participated in the first ever continuing education course at Rice in preparing for it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was sort of like computing. I mean, I did it before it existed. It was sort of like the high school where the kids went to school before it existed. We did. I don't know.
And in your project-based work, were you ever working on multiple projects at once, or was it mostly focused?
No, you only work on one project at once. It is very
okay.
Intensive work.
Okay.
You have to do along with the process engineer. You do the first analysis of it and try to establish a timeline of what could be done when and how much would be taken and how much resources you're going to need. And depending on the project, some of the projects, like the one in Gulf Cabinda in Africa, to understand that project, first of all, I did a drawing, and this is what I was trying to tell you about earlier. That project involved an onshore facility and three different offshore facilities and pipelines joining them and an offshore loading facility. And so I did a drawing of showing these things to show how they're related together so that people could grasp what we were talking about. The same thing was true of Yanbu, which was a very good, and I reduced it to one, you know, this huge thing, to one single drawing that told everything that was, not everything, told the how everything that was in all of those documents was connected. And those documents, everybody told me they were very, very useful to understand what was going on.
Let me ask you to maybe articulate, and it may build on that point. So as a project engineer, you're a lead project engineer, you're a team leader.
Right.
What kind of tenets of leadership did you feel you found over your career really worked the best?
Keeping good records, sending out after a meeting, sending out the meeting minutes of what happened. This is what I think we agreed. Did we agree to this? Yes, we did. Being understanding when people had a problem and needed additional help, making sure they got that help. That was important. And saying thank you. I guess those were, to me, that was thing. I kind of just did them all automatically. And then I pulled a real boo-boo. Everybody does that. You make mistakes.
Do you want to say more about what you mean by that?
Oh, that I'll save that for my other talks.
Okay.
The difference. The other thing that came out that back to what I found fascinating about working for Hudson was the different projects that I did. You know, I did the feasibility study of one particular thing for one particular company. I did the great big Yanbu project that used everybody in the company. And then I did another one where I was the project engineer for our first contract that we got with the government. And the company had never done a project working for Uncle Sam before. And this was for the helium plant that's up in Amarillo. Do y'all know that the Texas is the site of helium for the world?
No.
Yeah, it's in. The plant is up in Amarillo, and that's where the field is and everything. And it's a very old plant. It was built in the 20s or 10s or something like that, long, long time ago. So we get this to modify it and to add a new type of processing unit to their processing called pressure swing absorption, where you run the, you have a big tower and you put some stuff in it that the put the gas through and it absorbs on there and gets purified by going through this tower. And then you release the pressure on the tower and the bad stuff goes off. That's basically what happens. Well, we were dealing with helium. And like a very good, you know, there, whereas most gas plants deal in millions of standard cubic feet per day, the production there was, you know, very, very small. I've forgotten what the numbers were. Maybe 60 standard cubic feet per day. Very different scale. The Yanbu project had pipelines for the flare that were big enough to drive a Mack truck through. You know, you've seen those big Mack trucks pull up behind you on the highway. And just imagine a pipe big enough for them to drive. This project had major flow lines that carried our production flow of what we're doing that were not as big as my little finger. Okay. So, and it was in this existing antique facility, and all of the original drawings, of course, had not been kept up with all of the field modifications that had occurred over the years. And so we went up there in February. And Amarillo is in the panhandle of Texas, and just north of it is Alaska. And the winds come down from Alaska and blow over the panhandle, and it's colder than you could ever imagine. And I am there, bundled up, gloves and scarf and hat and hard hat, and trying to take notes. And my lead piper is down trying to find out where the pipes are that we have to connect to, and the pipe trenches are down in the ground, and he's crawling in and out of the trenches, and I'm making notes, and that's how we did our notes to get, and he literally had to go in and make drawings in the field of what was there to know how to do our piping to get it into this thing. So we come back and we get the design done and do all the spool drawings and everything, and we start buying all of the, this was an engineering and construction job. So our construction part of the company was involved too. So we buy all of the material for it, and instead of shipping it up to the job site, we ship it to our Hudson Products Company, which makes the fans. And we have a setup there and gather all of these pieces. Now remember, we're making, it's not like making the piping to go on that kitchen sink with those big pipes. No, these are these little tiny pipes and little tiny valves. And so you sort them out and you make whatever goes in a particular spool of piping, and all the little valves that go to it go into a little burlap sack. And so you have a spool in a burlap sack. Normally, in a job, you would go to the supply place and you would go in, I'm getting ready to do spool X655, I need a two something so valves and six this and blah, 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 and you pick the valves, you know, from, because they're big things that you gotta, these are little tiny things. So we did all of the pre-assembly of that, got it up there, and they were able to do it and to get it going and to get it working. And this project was like $1 million, which was a very small job. Even $1 million in those days was a lot of money to the ordinary person, but for a construction job, it was a small job. And we actually made a small profit on it. But that was one of the hardest things. And again, it was a no, it had to be no exception type bid. And getting it that way was very difficult. But we did it and we managed to make money on it. And the company never did another government job.
And was, why was that, and was, what was it about government work, government contracts?
The insistence on no exceptions,
okay,
no changes to the contract. And when, if you're dealing with somebody that's not willing to change what's going on while it's going on, you never know when you're doing something. What's, you go out and you start a project and you start digging in the ground, and there's a great big tree root, and you've got to chop that tree root and take it out. That's, you know, you don't plan for what you can't see. Or, mm-hmm. Instead of a tree root, it's a vein of an old concrete thing that has to be dynamited out. That's even worse than a tree root. See, how can you plan for, there may be a tree root or maybe a concrete bunker under that. You have no way of knowing.
It's a heavily debated area because there's something called contingency when
yes.
you get into these estimates.
Yeah, yeah, you do get some contingency, but there's certain things that you really can't plan for.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. That's why the business people have to do about all their negotiating and everything.
So during this time, you may not know, but I'm curious around pay. There's a lot about women's and equal pay, equal work. Do you have any idea?
I think I was being paid equally at Hudson.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that for a certainty, but I think I was.
Yeah. And I know something else you did. At one point you started and you led a summer program for engineering interns.
Okay, while I was at Hudson, in the prosperous years, we decided that we should, you know, help train, try to get some more engineers. Well, the company thought they would be expanding, needing more process engineers. We need more of them. Let's test getting some. And having an intern work for you for a summer gives you an idea. Do you really want to make them an offer? And so we did that. And I was in charge of recruiting the interns. And we had the program for 2 years and had a good group of people from all over, including from some of the northern schools.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a young lady, I remember, from University of Michigan, I think. And most of them went, most of people end up going back to where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
It's just people do like old home town.
And what, to what extent were they involved in the work? Like, what kinds of work were they
okay,
doing?
They happened to be the summer that we did the Yambu project for Yeah, you have to do for Aramco, the bid. So they worked on that bid. One of them, I told, I want you to equip the hospital emergency room. And so they had to go out and find out the cost of an ambulance and the cost of all of the exam tables to people on and what you needed to have and the cabinets and all to furnish the. They didn't have to do design the building for it. Somebody else in my architecture department had designed that building. I mean, that involved a grassroots town as well as everything else. And one of them got the job of finding out the drain field for the sewage treatment. And they had to design and find out. One of them had to do the fire department. So I used them for all sorts of this. So they had to contact different companies and find out and get bids. And it was hilarious. They found out that I didn't know engineering was this.
And did you ever talk with them about, you know, your thoughts about the field or
Yes. I trained them to write a weekly report on what they had done and to have a goal and have little meetings and talk with each other. It was a training thing too, but most of the time I had them working.
Do you know if any of those interns ended up staying with the company?
I don't remember. I really don't remember.
So you worked for Hudson for a dozen years, I guess.
I worked for them for almost 10 years.
How did the use of computers kind of change the work, or did
Yes, tremendously. When I started at Hudson, they were very progressive. They had computers with that did the word processing, and they had these, you know, young ladies that did the thing real fast, and so you could write your report and you give it to them, and then they could whip it, and then you could mark it up and give it back to them, paste it, and they knew how to take it and move and paste, like every one of us knows how to do nowadays. Not so in those days. You had specialists that knew how to do it, and you gave them a cut up piece of paper that was taped all together, that then they worked from that. So that's what it was when I moved in. And shortly thereafter, maybe 4 or 5 years, I was doing project engineering, the spreadsheets were developed. And I had a project that was located someplace, you know, overseas. And to get the materials for the project, there were different places you would buy it in the United States, and then you had to get it all together and connect it and put it together and put it in a ship and ship it over. And there's varying routes about how you can do this. So there's different parameters that you could. So I made a spreadsheet of all the different parameters, and we could show that you could change the parameters, and then you could go through and figure out what it was. And this involved what materials you had and what material, and you need different processes too, so different stuff that you needed. And it would have taken our material takeoff people like 6 weeks to do one of these calculations. And I put in all the parameters, and it could do the calculation in about 6 hours. And you know, I wasn't afraid to try it out and to do it and got it going. Everybody of the management in the company came in and stood behind, you know, because I had to stay in there to be sure nobody messed with my computer that foul it up. But they all came and they stood and watched it do its thing, blubbity 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 blub, until it finally converged. And that, and then we got the computer that we could use to do our design calculations towards the end. And after that, they finally developed the ability to do these drawings that our pipers did on a computer. But that was after I had left Hudson. Now, with Hudson, it was, first of all, it was word processing, and then it was the spreadsheet. And that was used in essentially economic analysis. And I guess they used it in the accounting department, right? don't remember.
So I know you had some, you were recognized with various things around this period. So you, as you mentioned, became the first fellow, female fellow of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers.
Right.
And you also received a recognition award from the Gas Processors Suppliers Association.
Right.
So how did it feel to receive those kinds of recognition?
Kind of big head. I mean, it was something. The female fellow really, I mean, that really thrilled me. It really did.
Did you know the application was going in?
No.
Do you know who did the nomination?
I think I do, but I've never pursued trying to know. I guess this is really the first recognition I ever had on my work was when Ricky nominated me for Sigma Psi. And mm-hmm. I'm a full member of Sigma Psi. As far as I know of no other person who does not have a PhD who's a full member of Sigma Psi. There must be some. Mm-hmm. But the Sigma Psi Award is associate membership is given to PhD students in the field. Most of them have that. Mm-hmm. And then after, if they go into academia and then continue to see, then they are elected to full, and I was elected directly to full membership.
Hmm. Was there some kind of ceremony when?
No,
there
was no ceremony. Just,
okay.
Just a, you're a member, that was it.
Okay. And have you, is it something social?
I don't
like, do you meet people?
No, I don't. I've never participated in it.
Okay.
It's just one of those things that, you know, I was very honored to do it, but I
mm-hmm.
have not participated in it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we got it on camera or on the recording yet, but you were telling us off recording a story about when you became a fellow and received your certificate. So I was wondering if you could share that story if you haven't already.
Well, I was elected a fellow and I was the first female, and so I received my certificate in the mail, I guess it was. I don't remember exactly. I don't think we had award ceremonies in those days. And lo and behold, it was an award to him and to his. And I laughed and put it in a frame and put it up on the wall. Well, a few years later, another woman was elected, and she protested, and I've forgotten who that was. Do you remember or know?
Was it Rousseau? I don't remember.
It may have been Margaret.
It may have been Margaret, yeah.
Yeah. She'd be one of the other early ones. She was another Rice graduate. And so she objected. I bet it was her. And they mailed me another certificate with her in it. So I have a his and a her certificate. And those are going to go into the archives of the Society of Women Engineers. I've already promised them to them.
So I think it might be good to hear some of your thoughts about changes in the oil industry around this time, because I know it ended up affecting your employment, so I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about the context of the industry, how it was doing, and how that affected your work.
It's not just the oil industry, it's the economics of the United States. And you have to look at the overall. And if you do, you will find that there is a cycle of up and down. Mm-hmm. And if you examine the history of employment of engineers of all disciplines, there are similar cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And when it goes down, everybody loses their job and they forget that they need engineers. And then they suddenly discover 10 years later they don't have any engineers and they desperately need more engineers. So more people go into engineering, and then you suddenly discover you don't need so many, and so you don't. So it goes up and down, and that's the history of it. In the oil industry, you need the energy, and then you don't need the energy, and the same thing. It's just part of our overall economic cycling that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And we happened at in the time of the late mid-80s, be at a down cycle. And first of all, my husband was offered to take early retirement. He was very young at the time to do this. He was in his late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was offered early retirement from Cheryl had tried to make John into a administrator, and he tried it for 6 months and it didn't fit him at all, and he refused to do it. And so he was their highest level researcher that you could have. He had his parking slot at the laboratory with his name on it was immediately by the door. It was the best parking spot in the entire company. I mean, he was really something. John was consulted by a lot of other people. He was very highly respected. But, of course, he was paid very highly, too. So when you're cutting, your expenses, and who do you cut? If you cut your, you can cut one high guy for two lower paying guys. And so he was offered, and he got a very generous retirement package, you know, a full, I've forgotten the details, but you know, maybe a full year's pay and whatever it was. And so he decided, and we decided, yeah, he might as well take it.
Was there a pension as well?
Oh, yes.
Michelle?
Oh, yes, a pension, but he didn't start the pension.
Right.
Did his pension start then? Maybe it did. I think maybe his pension started. Hmm. We didn't have to take Social Security at that point, and you didn't have to take enough out of your... And Shell had a very, very generous program at the time I worked for them, which he had started with. Of course, I didn't work for them long enough to be effective, but they called it the Shell Provident Fund. And you could start contributing to it after you had been an employee for 1 year, and you could contribute 1% of your salary or something, and then when 5 years you could do 5%, and if it's 10 years you did 10%, and then the company matched what you donated, and then those funds were invested. And so when you retired, you got this total thing, and this became your individual retirement account. Well, you could withdraw the funds that you personally put in at any time. So when it came time to educate our children, we withdrew from his contribution, and that's why we were able to support our children to the extent that they could all go to the college they wanted to and study what they wanted to. And they also worked all the time when they went and contributed to their own. I think that's important, that you could help to pay your own. But it did take essentially all of what we had contributed up to that time. So then when he did retire from Shell, and they gave us the check for, they planned the retirement, did all sorts of things to help you and what you're going to do and look at your economic, blah, blah, blah. And they provided a continuation of your health insurance, which was very important. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm still on it. Mm-hmm. So, and then we got this gigantic to us check of what had been accumulated in the Provident Fund. And rushed down to our broker and, you know, immediately established the way it is, it was in his name on the IRA. In the meantime, we had already started IRAs and had put in whatever it was that you could contribute to your individual IRA. The laws have been changing on that all the time. The minute they started the IRA program, we started contributing to it. So I had a very small one and continued to contribute to it through the years. So I have a very small IRA originally. But that one, and that became our major. That happened to be at the beginning of a huge expansion in the stock market. And those funds significantly increased in size to the point that I really have no financial worries at all. In fact, I can't possibly spend all of my required withdrawal from my RRA. I personally use my money to establish scholarships. I have a endowed scholarship for women in engineering at Rice University. This year I established a new one at Houston Community College. I have a scholarship with Voices of America for a young man, this is for music, and he is from Africa, a baritone, and it provides for his incidental expenses. He's finishing his senior year. I will continue to support him in incidental expenses as he goes to graduate school, I hope. And in addition, I support my church. with a full tie and plus a lot of extra things. And I have it in the past, have had personal scholarships or through no agency at all to divinity students. So it's very nice to have money to be able to give it away. And I've been able to help some of my great-grandchildren who have had learning disabilities that have required, one of them is autistic, and we were able to get her into a special school, and she's now in the second grade and top one in her class and doing beautifully in school because she got early help. And I had the money to do that. It's really wonderful to be able to pay for something that's needed when it's needed.
So what year did John take the early retirement then? That was 80?
84. 89. It was just before I got laid off, whatever those dates work out.
Okay. So you were laid off in 1986.
86. Mm-hmm. Well, then he took it in 85, I guess it was.
So he was...
I have to go back.
You were still working when he was at, not working.
Yes.
For a little while. And then you got laid off.
And then I got laid off.
Was that welcome or just...
No, I liked what I liked working. And I miss it. I mean, I miss the challenge and all. But at that time, working wasn't fun. I mean, we didn't have projects to work on. They had us engineers up working the accounting department, matching invoices with receipts and that sort of thing. And nobody was having any fun. So I got laid off, and the company had at that time was supporting me to be a director of AICHE, and they continued through that year. But I had to resign at the end of the year and not go into my third year because the company would not support me, and I didn't feel like I wanted to take my personal money and go off to the meetings three times a year. You know, it just, to me, didn't seem like it was a very good idea. But the company hired me back, and about 3 or 4 months after I got laid off, the vice president in Britain had to give a talk on enhanced oil recovery, I think it was. I found the notes on that last night in there. And so I had to be a ghostwriter. So I came back and did whatever research, because that's not my field of expertise, but I did enough to look it up and to write a learned paper in that area so that he could get up and sound like he knew what he was talking about. And that did that. And then when it came to be December, I think Hafez Aghili was the head of engineering by this time, and he had done his doctorate at Rice, and I had actually helped him on his thesis. And working on his thesis at one time, I remember he asked me, "Patsy, does everybody have to satisfy you on their thesis?" And I told him, I said, "No, only those that end up having a good thesis." Well, he had been head of engineering when I got laid off. Then he hires me back. I think they realized that I might bring a lawsuit against them. Mm-hmm. And so they hired me back to help critique a design that one of the engineers had done, younger. And it was a government job, but it was a different one. It was the strategic oil reserves that they put in the salt domes. And as they sit there and sit there and sit there, the vapor pressure increases and it reaches a point that it's not safe, and so you have to go in and treat it. Well, the company was hired to do these, design and install these facilities to reduce the vapor pressure. And so because it was a government job, I think they wanted to have somebody outside view it. But this time, remember, things... automation had come in, and drawings would be done automated, and all this kind of stuff. Well, they hired me to come in. It's a good thing they did, because I came in. Well, okay, I'm going to review it, and so I reviewed all of his drawings and everything. And went out to the plant site where they were building the thing, and went around and looked at everything. lo and behold, it has a brand new analytical instrument on it. And I came home and talked to John about it, and John and I looked at it, and he got out his magic pencil and did the mathematics, and we proved that if we could meet the requirements, that this instrument said you were okay, but it really was conservative. It really was over meeting. But they needed a verification that we can really make this do it. So that was a part of it. Well, I gave them that proof, part of my thing. But then we went in the field, and there was the analytical room where the equipment was supposed to come in. And the pipes are coming out where this machine is going to come in and be plugged up with it. Well, the only problem was, when they had done their piping design work, they had failed to notice that this machine came in on wheels, and so its pipes came out. So here were the pipes on the wall, and here were the pipes of the machine, because it's got the wheels under it. So I found that. And then I'm looking around and looking at the piping, and I discovered that when you're doing something and you have to reach a certain condition before you say, okay, it's done enough that we can go and put this into production now, you have what's called resample going on. So you have to have a sample of your product, what you're sending to. When that sample doesn't work, you cut it off. They were taking the sample at the wrong point. So they would never be able to get it to work. Well, because I had gotten out all of his drawings, looked at stuff and found stuff, I knew what to look for. So, yeah, and so I worked for them for 4 or 5 weeks. And so that made my total time at the company to exceed 10 years, so then they could start giving me a pension. And that's when they started paying me $479 a month. I forgot what the number is. I can go look it up. A month, and they've been paying it to me ever since. And I'm glad I've lived a long time.
Did you know that was coming, or?
Sort of, not. I don't remember. That was a long time ago.
Okay.
I was very busy having grandchildren at the time.
Yeah.
Could we take a break for a moment?
Sure.